This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Good morning, and welcome to the Indie Media Show, here on the fine, fine airwaves of Archer FM 92.1, the sound alternative. Very excited, as always, to be with you. I'm your host, Alex Wisson, flying solo today in the studio without the encumbrance, the hindrance of one Ramon Granfeld or my more illustrious colleagues, Zoe and Joni. Jeff liked that one. So big thank you, of course, to Jeff Bullen, as always, for another fine edition of On The Record, and you can listen to On The Record every weekday. Plenty coming up on the show, so I won't dilly-dally too much. We've got actually a couple of long and very engaging interviews for you, including with one long-time contributor, regular contributor to the show. He often wears various different hats. He's got plenty of interesting and insightful comments to make about, politics and social struggles in lots of different parts of the world. Really, I'm talking about Federico Fuentes. He's a political commentator, author, organiser. He's also an Argentinian-Australian, and so he has, you could say, sort of a personal family connection, of course, with Argentina, but also a lot of political insight into what's happening in that country. Why are we talking about Argentina? Well, because it's potentially a pretty important political testing ground, you could say, for a very nasty form of authoritarian neoliberalism, a mix of harsh austerity economics and right-wing authoritarian populism in the form of the newly elected president, Javier Milei, who's just got through the Senate of the Argentinian Congress, a large omnibus bill that contains a lot of counter-reforms, which, as is typical of the Western capitalist press, counter-reforms in a sort of textbook Orwellian fashion are referred to as reforms, which, of course, reform is something progressive. So a counter-reform is something that's regressive. So it's the whole reality of what's taking place with this sort of legislation is inverted by the capitalist press, because suffice to say they are counter-reforms, attacking pensions, attacking working-class living standards, cutting taxes for the rich, privatising public services, you name it. It's the typical neoliberal playbook that's playing out there, with the twist of a Trump-like authoritarian figure in the form of Javier Milei, who, weirdly enough, they describe himself as an anarcho-capitalist. I guess a Steinerite would be the term for those of a more theoretical bent. But an interesting discussion coming up with Federico Fuentes on what's happening there in Argentina. And also going to be hearing from a radical folk singer who's very prolific singer, actually. He's sort of tours all around the world at lots of protest camps and sites. Great guy. I actually had the opportunity to meet him at a UN climate summit way back when in Copenhagen. Which is when I first sort of became familiar with his music. He pumps out just lots of songs, lots of albums about all kinds of, as I say, protest movements throughout the world, including recently songs about the genocide in Gaza, his new album, Bearing Witness. I'm talking about David Rovix. So I'll be hearing a little bit about David later on, who's going to be actually performing this weekend at the Eco-Socialism Conference at the Boorloo Activist Centre. So we'll give you the details of that a little later on. So plenty coming up here on the Indie Media Show. Do stay tuned.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
And you're back with the Indie Media Show here on Archer FM 92.1 with your host, Alex Wisson. As I say, interesting stuff happening in Argentina. It's been a mixed set of fortunes for the right-wing populist president, Javier Milei, in the month of June, with large protests against his social counter-reforms, but also in the end, the successful passing through the National Parliament of at least the provisional legislation for those counter-reforms. He's also been on a whirlwind tour of Europe, meeting with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and also, rather delightfully for him, I'm sure, receiving an award in Hamburg from the Friedrich Hayek Society for presumably his services to the cause of neoliberal capitalism. A little earlier this morning, I had the opportunity to speak to Argentinian-Australian political commentator and longtime contributor to the Indie Media Show, Federico Fuentes. And I began by asking him to take a bit of a step back and contextualise exactly who Javier Milei is, what his politics are, and why, in his estimation, he was elected president last November.
Javier Milei is an economist by trade. He was someone who had a bit of a profile in the mainstream media as a political commentator who was invited onto programs, but who really sort of rises to prominence around the time of the COVID pandemic. During the COVID pandemic, the Argentinian government at that time implemented quite strong lockdown measures. Somewhat akin to what we had here in Australia, and in fact, in some cases, much longer lockdowns than what we had here in Australia. And Javier Milei came to very much represent the political voice of those who were stringently opposed to lockdown. He presented himself as the representative of freedom and liberty. So for him, he viewed that as freedom and liberty in the sense of opposing the lockdown, but also he applies that to his economic policy. So he's one for extreme free market. The way to solve all of Argentina's economic problems is just to get rid of all state intervention and return back to the free market. Based on that basic political outlook, in 2020, 2021, he sets up his party, Liberty Advances, very quickly rises in the polls, gets some deputies, some senators elected into the National Congress. And by the time of the national elections, the presidential elections that occurred last year, is amongst the front runners. What Milei is able to do is, firstly, in the first round of the election, defeat the traditional right, which is a coalition of different centre-right-wing parties who were trying to get their own presidential candidate up, which was Patricia Bullrich. He's able to defeat them and get into the second round, where in the second round he then has to face off against Argentina's sort of historically biggest political force, which is the Peronist Party, which, you know, is a broad church. It involves people from the left wing, from the right wing, from the centre. But we could certainly say that the presidential candidate that the Peronists put forward in those elections, and they were the governing party before those elections, was someone from the centre. In that context, he's very much able to ride a wave that combines two elements. First is, having defeated the traditional right candidate and got through to the second elections, he already brings together all of the traditional right vote that opposes Peronism. So that's one part of his block. But he's able to expand that, and that's why he's able to win by such a big majority in the second round elections, obtaining around 55% of the vote, because he's able to capture a whole bunch of society that's just discontent with politics altogether. So it's not uncommon to what we've seen, around the world. These sort of outsider candidates presenting themselves against the political class. In this case, his opposition to the political class is lockdown and state intervention into the economy, combined with a mixture of other crazier policies. But the crux of his politics is that, and he's able to capture that discontent and ride that wave into the presidency. So that's how we get this sort of president. I think there's also that's at the political level. I think there's one other factor that is definitely worth considering, is that Argentina for pretty much about the last decade has been in a pretty serious economic crisis. And poverty has been essentially doubled over that period. Unemployment has risen. So just general life conditions have gotten extremely tough in Argentina. So in the face of that, it kind of was not really a surprise that the large part of society turned its back on the two traditional coalitions that had governed the country for most of that time, the Peronists and the traditional right coalition. And sought an outlet for that discontent, sought an outlet for that despair, and Milei was that outlet in those last elections.
Let's come now to the legislation itself, which narrowly passed the Senate 37 votes to 36, with Milei's Vice President Victoria Villarreal casting the deciding vote. It's an omnibus bill containing a large suite of social counter-reforms, although the breadth of that legislation was watered down in an effort to get it through the Senate, and also needs to then pass through the lower house before it becomes law. And indeed, more generally, Malay has had great trouble passing any kind of laws. This is the first legislation he's managed to get sort of through the Argentine Congress. But precisely what are those counter reforms contained within this omnibus bill, and why did the bill lead to such large protests?
So contained in this bill is really the kind of the economic, the fiscal aspect of what Milei wants from it. So it covers a whole range of stuff in there. But I think we could probably pinpoint, let's say, two or three aspects that are very key, or at least the most contentious ones. One is the issue of privatisation. So, of course, Milei's position is that anything that is state-owned must be privatised. There is support in Congress for that position, but there is hesitancy to go as far as he wants to do. So one of the things that, at least in the Senate, that he's had to back down from is privatisation of some of the key industries currently in state hands. One of them, for example, is Aerolíneas Argentina, the state airline, which had been in public hands, was privatised, almost went to the verge of collapse, and so was brought back into state hands. I think that history makes certainly some politicians reticent to see the privatisation of Aerolíneas Argentina. The energy company, Enarsa, is another one that's a contentious one. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is essentially trying to get rid of, you know, what he would refer to as red tape that stops investment coming into the country. So it's essentially trying to open up Argentina's market as much as possible by removing any barriers or anything that's deemed to be a barrier for foreign investment into the country. And then the third, I think, important aspect is labour reform. And this overlaps with the second part of your question about why is there so much resistance. And I think that is because, in large part, if we compare Argentina to the rest of South America at least, Argentina is probably the country where neoliberal reforms, whilst having been implemented quite harshly in Argentina, have not been able to be implemented as harshly as they were elsewhere. And in particular, when it comes to the issue of labour reform. So compared to other countries, things like union rights, or the weight that unions have in the workplace, is much stronger than it is elsewhere. I'm not exaggerating. Obviously, there's been a strong winding back of those rights. But unions maintain a strength that they may not have, for instance, when we compare it to Chile, when we compare it to Brazil, for example. So that's why you generate this important opposition, which comes from several fronts. The first one, obviously, is the trade unions, who do not want to lose those rights that they've been able to defend over time. It also generates opposition from those sectors of the government, or the old government, but also regional governments, who see an interest in maintaining state control over at least some particular public companies, and don't want to see them privatised, because they've seen the history of what happens when these companies get privatised. Essentially, they're sold off to the lowest bidder, and then basically run down, stripped, and almost brought to the verge of collapse. So you see a political opposition as well that's reflected in Congress in terms of the votes, but also a political opposition that's reflected outside Congress, where you have governors and mayors who oppose some of these measures and are also seeking to mobilise their voter base, their support base, to apply pressure on the National Congress.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt there, Fred, but that really brings me on my next question, that in terms of to what extent is there an independent political character to these protest movements? Because you've said that's perhaps relates to some of the croniest networks, corrupt networks of the old Peronist power structure, in terms of them controlling those publicly owned companies taking the cream off the top, so to speak, and there have been members of parliament involved in those protests, as well as trade unions. So is there an independent political character outside of the official Peronist opposition? Are they controlling these protests, or do they have the potential, these protests, to have a life of their own and be more sustainable and grassroots based?
I think it's a dynamic thing that potentially exists. But I think it's certainly the case that, you know, the existing institutions, be that the Peronist Party, be that the trade unions, be that regional or local politicians, still carry a certain weight. What at the same time we are seeing is that discontent, which I spoke about before, which paved the way for the rise of Malay, has not disappeared. And whilst there's been a bit of a honeymoon period and a willingness for the people to see if Malay will be able to fix the problem, and the fact that the situation continues to deteriorate means that that's a ticking time bomb for Malay as well, because that discontent hasn't gone away. It may not may have allowed a breathing space, but you're already starting to see some spontaneous elements of protest as well, of that discontent being expressed on the street. The challenge is that, as for now, that sort of more spontaneous element is very disparate, quite disorganized. So you see the difference. You see the difference, for instance, that the bigger mobilizations are clearly the ones when the trade unions get on board and call it, or when the Peronist Party backs it. But that's not to say that they're the only ones that get mobilized on that on those days. And that's not to say things aren't happening outside of those orbits. So I think the potential exists, but the challenge is that those networks at the moment are quite fragmented, are quite weak. So how do you build on that is something that's been attempted to do. And I think that's going to take a while because of the nature of, well, not really just Argentinian politics, but politics in the region, where after 20, 30 years of neoliberalism and the impact that's had on just a general social fabric, attempting to rebuild that in a context where, as I said, the economic crisis is still very deep, poverty still continues to rise, is a big challenge. But if Argentina has showed anything, certainly during this neoliberal period, Argentinians have shown that they're not afraid to come out onto the streets and to overthrow presidents if need be. And Milei is certainly aware of that history. In fact, he tries to claim that history for himself to say that he is the political embodiment of that rebellious spirit. He says that he's the more genuine representative than those that have tried to co-opt it in the past. Well, he'll have to be able to demonstrate some concrete wins if he's not able to, you know, feel the wrath of that same discontent that others have had to deal with.
Yeah, you spoke to one element of his politics, which is clearly an appeal to populism. And indeed, the last time we spoke to you, Federico, we had a debate, which some of our listeners may have thought of as quite a pedantic and semantic debate or discussion, really, over, you know, exactly what type of political phenomenon Javier Milei represents. He describes himself as an anarcho-capitalist. Is he a populist? Is he an orthodox neoliberal? He's probably actually a combination of all of those things, in my estimation, but at least rhetorically, and you sort of just touched on that in terms of this faux rebellious persona that he likes to portray to the Argentinian public, you know, this sort of Trump-like figure who's there to drain the swamp, to get rid of corruption, to right the economic ship in Argentina. And really, you know, and you can make a comparison also with Bolsonaro in Brazil, a similar sort of figure who, certainly when Bolsonaro came to power, there was a sense in which he wanted to totally upend, root and branch, the Brazilian state. Malay, I mean, how much of it is bluster and rhetoric, I suppose, is the question. Does he really want to transform the Argentinian state root and branch and you know, ultimately turn it into an instrument of his political will? Or, you know, are there, just as there was in Brazil with Bolsonaro, there's institutional inertia there. There are, you know, ruling class interests that are already in place, and it's not as though Malay can just make, you know, this powerful state an instrument of his will. So do you think that this is rhetoric and bluster? How transformative a presidency, I suppose, is the question. How transformative a presidency could Malay's, you know, time in office be?
Well, but Malay has this problem, which is that his rise, the speed of his rise far outweighs the ability that he's had to construct a coherent, organised social force that can actually implement his agenda. So in terms of the state, actually, I mean, he sees the state as the final enemy. I mean, he's referred to it as, like, he refers to the state as a pedophile let loose in a kindergarten, you know, and then therefore that's how the state should be treated. So he's
transformative project is to whittle down the state to as little as possible. But he has one problem, is that, you know, whilst the rhetorically that may get certain appeal, how do you do that in practice? And more importantly, how do you build a social base to be able to implement that when it doesn't exist? And he hasn't been able to figure out how to do that. So what he's had to do then is rely on his alliance with the traditional right, who also are critical of the state, but only to a certain extent. So you get this kind of weird dilemma where you have, on the one hand, the president, Milei, who's a libertarian, who's supposedly anti-state, as you said, an anarcho-capitalist he's identified as, but whose vice president is a lawyer who defended the military dictatorship of the people from the military dictatorship of the 70s in Argentina. I mean, one can't think of anything more of a powerful state than a military dictatorship. But he's now forced to kind of have to compromise his original project as part of building this alliance. So the question will be, what's going to win out? Will Milei be able to win out just through his own personal appeal, by being the figure that's associated with the discontent, by being able to sort of say, well, look, if people voted for me, for my program, or is he ultimately going to have to default and rely on the traditional right, who do have social base, who do have an organised, party framework, who do have members that have been installed in different government posts and who know how to run those government posts, to be able to carry out a mixed project. And that's really the bit of the challenge, and that's even the challenge that he's facing in trying to get his bills through Parliament. As you said, and as I mentioned before, that because of his rise, his presence in Parliament is far, far smaller than his presidential vote would indicate. So he's already dependent on other traditional right parties themselves, that are a coalition who have their own internal differences, just to get anywhere near a majority, and often then has to involve other parties outside of that. So whether he's going to be able to implement his project or not, I think is certainly an open question. I think it's going to be much more difficult than he envisaged it, although he still believes that he's able to be able to push forward on his project.
Finally, Federico, it was very noticeable that Milei received something of a rock star welcome among radical right-wing forces during his recent trip to Europe. Warmly welcomed, for instance, to the G7 summit by Italian Prime Minister Giorgio Meloni. And his attacks on the poor and the working class have, perhaps unsurprisingly, been roundly endorsed and indeed celebrated by the capitalist press throughout the Western world. How important is his presidency, do you think, on a broader regional and international scale? I described his rule earlier as you could describe it, as the Milei experiment. Could it be the case that his mix of authoritarianism and neoliberal economics serves as a kind of prototype? Because certainly he's attracted a lot of international attention. A lot of ruling class strategists, commentators, journalists, politicians are paying attention to Milei's rule in Argentina. And could they be viewing his presidency as a potential model for stabilising capitalist rule elsewhere in the world?
I think they view his presidency important, as something that's important. I think particularly because it reflects in South America a partial pushback against a more recent leftist or centre-leftist turn. So, you mentioned Bolsonaro in Brazil, but in the last elections, he lost out to the centre-left in terms of Lula and the Workers' Party. And we've also seen other centre-left governments return to power or be elected, be that in Chile, in Colombia, in Mexico. So regionally, he plays an important role. In terms of Latin America, probably together with the El Salvadorian president, Bukele, really are the two figureheads of this sort of global far right that has been emerging. I think he also plays an important role in being the personality he is, where he's not afraid to say what he wants, and he's able to push boundaries, that often some of the other far right figures are a bit more hesitant to sort of really raise those kind of issues. However, in terms of a model, I think perhaps that's not so much the case, and that's largely because there are differences we can see within these far right organisations. For instance, very few of the far right organisations have such a libertarian outlook as what Milei does in terms of the economy. Actually, if we look at, for instance, like Le Pen in France, I mean, there, you know, we see that the far right, the French far right, talk about, you know, oh, we're actually going to defend the pension age, or we're going to defend pensions, or, you know, we are going to defend certain social welfare. Of course, they couch it in that only for the French people. That's where the racism, the anti-immigration comes in. But their actual social policies and economic policies are not really the same as what Milei advocates. So don't see Milei as being a model for the far right, but I certainly think the global far right sees Milei as a bulwark against the return of the traditional right in Latin America, and something that can be built on to help see if they can, you know, return other right-wing forces to power in the region. And also someone who's going to always be there pushing boundaries on the global stage and creating a space to help, you know, sort of normalize the far right, which is really what I think globally the far right has been trying to do over the last 10, 15 years, present itself as no longer the fringe, no longer the extreme, but actually part of accepted politics. And Milei, I think, helps in that context for them.
That was political commentator and Argentinian-Australian journalist Federico Fuentes talking to us there about the whys and wherefores of the Javier Milei presidency in Argentina.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
I'm going to jump now into our next interview. American folk singer, activist and author David Rovix has been touring since the 1990s, performing all over the world and frequently at demonstrations. As a lifelong anti-war activist, it's no surprise that his latest album, Bearing Witness, focuses on the ongoing genocide in Gaza. He's currently in Australia touring his new album, and indeed he's actually going to launch that tour this weekend at the Eco-Socialism Conference, the Boorloo Activist Centre in Aberdeen Street, Perth. Dinner and then concerts, or dinner starting at 7 p.m. and then concert at 8 p.m. So check out the Eco-Socialism Conference agenda more broadly, where David Rovix will be performing on Saturday night. And my colleague Ray Grenfield had the opportunity to catch up with David this morning, and he began by asking him what his motivations were for, in terms of putting together his latest album.
Definitely a mix of a lot of the sorts of things I've been covering for decades, and with a real heavy emphasis on Gaza and Palestine and what's been happening there since October, which has definitely taken up about 90% of my songwriting and essay writing efforts since October.
Yeah, and I guess talking about Gaza, I mean, that it's something I think, you know, for a lot of us, it just occupies so much of our mental and our sort of emotional energy, and obviously it's a lot more for people who are directly involved or perhaps have family involved. You know, you do have quite a few songs on this album about that, but do you find it... I mean, obviously, there's the element of writing this music to get a message out there to people that are perhaps not aware or not convinced. But I guess there's also a cathartic element to it as well. I imagine that you need to be able to express those feelings and that outrage as well when you're writing an album.
There's that. I mean, I'd say generally that playing music and writing songs are both really therapeutic and cathartic activities as a general rule. But definitely, like, since the genocide began, I have been trying to just do my job as a songwriter, knowing as I do that songs can be powerful, you know, tools for communicating and popular education and for even, you know, changing people's minds, you know, and if they're able to play that role because of the participation of a lot of other, you know, players in that process of getting a song out there and making it sound good and getting it to the right people and that sort of thing. But songs have a great potential for doing a lot of things. So I just have been trying to do what I do and write songs and trying to tackle different angles of what's going on, like because there's different ways to try to reach different people, and then I'm often just responding to the kinds of memes and, you know, tropes that are being circulated on social media or in the news. And in other cases, I'm just directly involved with a lot of stuff, like getting attacked by various groups like UK Lawyers for Israel and the different Zionist groups, and I'm responding to their attacks, you know, in the form of songs as well. So there's a whole mix of a lot of different things going on there.
It is interesting. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, I guess that we live in a reality now of sort of platforms and social media, and, you know, it has changed, obviously, the music industry, but it's also changed social movements and political activism considerably as well. Has it changed your approach to what you do, you know, considering now that there is this real emphasis on, you know, anyone, no matter whether they're, you know, in a DIY anarchist crust punk band or something, there's a weird expectation that they have to engage with creating content and doing all the social media stuff. Has it impacted on what you do and how you perform and how you perceive your music?
Yeah, in a massive way, in all kinds of ways. I would kind of like separate these kinds of themes into two categories. One would be the internet, and the other would be, you know, social media corporations and their algorithms and their billionaires and their disinformation and all that, you know, which is also part of the internet. But I'm old enough, I think you might be too, to remember before social media and when the internet, during what I now call the golden age of the internet, which was when the internet was an incredibly useful tool for organizing and popular education and disseminating all sorts of left-wing ideas and alternative music. And, you know, it was an amazing tool, and I started using it as soon as the MP3 was invented. I was one of the first users of MP3s, and I gave away all my music long before people were doing that, and I did it on purpose because it was a way to get it out there, and it really worked. And, you know, the internet has been an amazing tool, but it's been hijacked by a billionaire NSA, CIA run, literally, corporations that are out to brainwash us all and put us in our little pods. And it's just like the movie The Matrix. You know, people really should all see the 1999 movie The Matrix. Forget about the sequels, they're horrible, but the 1999 movie The Matrix, that explains exactly what's happening now. It's everything but literally. You know, we're not actually in physical pods, you know, with our brains hooked up to machines, but we might as well be, you know.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we know that very well here at Indie Media. Indie Media, I think, was very much a part of that golden age where
there was actual
potential and possibility for a truly radically democratic media.
Indie Media was one of the central institutions of the golden age of the internet. Absolutely.
Definitely. Returning to your album, Bearing Witness, I did say, you know, there's a heavy focus on Gaza. The first three tracks, This Is Genocide, Song for Aaron Bushnell, and Song for Gaza, clearly indicate that. You know, you yourself have been involved in, you know, solidarity activism for Palestine for a long time, as have we here at the Indie Media Show. It feels, and I just wanted to get your sense of what's happening in the States, because it feels as though that we've reached a bit of a critical juncture in terms of the international solidarity movement in terms of support for Palestine. While what has happened, obviously, in Gaza and in the West Bank is absolutely horrific since October the 7th, and as you correctly say with your first song, This Is a Genocide, at the same time, it does feel as though the international sort of movement has never been greater, has never had more strength. And I guess talking about music, you've got people like Macklemore coming out and writing, you know, songs in support of Palestine. And, you know, it seems it's almost become mainstream. Has that been your experience in the States? And do you think that it has reached, you know, I guess a critical turning point where you know, although it is so horrendous, so barbaric, and, you know, just horrible what's happening there, that there might be at least some semblance of hope and potential justice for the Palestinian people coming out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of like, as with so many things, it's a complicated phenomenon that's going on. And I think it's really important to unpack what's happening. Although I think as we're right in the middle of it, it can be really hard to see what's going on. But I think for one thing, like everything you say is true. You know, there is a genocide happening, and there is a bigger movement globally in opposition to this genocide than anything that I have ever seen. And I mean, you know, we had. It's good to qualify such statements. You know, we know, you know, that there was a massive international movement in opposition to the genocidal U.S. war against the people of Vietnam. I mean, that was also a huge movement. I think this movement is even bigger. Not sure if it's necessarily more organized than that was, because that went on for a long time and became highly organized, especially in the United States. In the United States, if we're talking about specifically the United States, there's absolutely no question the movement against the war in Vietnam was much, much bigger than this movement. Absolutely no question. But if we're talking about globally, then I think there's equally no question that this movement against the genocide of the Palestinians is bigger than any anti-war movement or perhaps any other kind of movement that I've ever seen. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And, you know, the main one is that this is a genocidal war. And that probably the secondary one, I would say, is that there are Muslims everywhere. There's more than a billion Muslims on this planet. And the fact is that, the vast majority of them, as far as I can tell, identify viscerally with the plight of the Palestinians. You know, that's just the reality. And I think that plays into this. Like maybe in a way that, you know, there's a more of a feeling of identification perhaps with the Palestinians globally than there might have been with the Vietnamese, just for sort of reasons of diaspora and the language and everything. And so a lot of different reasons, but it's a huge movement and a huge crimes against humanity going on, but it's not playing out the same way in the United States as it's playing out in many other countries. And there's a complicated array of reasons why I would say that is the case. Although you do find there is a movement similar in cities like New York or Seattle or San Francisco, certainly there's a movement very similar to the kind of thing that I think Australia has been experiencing, you know, for the past 8 months in cities like Sydney, you know. But the other thing that's going on in addition to a genocide and a massive movement against the genocide is the social media platforms that have decided that one's opinion on this genocide is all they want to feed us information or stuff about. I mean, the social media platforms have decided that this is something we should argue about. And I think it is certainly, like, you know, to the extent that there's anything we should argue about, this is something we should argue about. You know, I'm against this genocide very much, but I think I'm not sure what we do with this information, but it's worth noting that platforms like Instagram and TikTok and other platforms, you know, have decided that this is all we should see. Is marches and responses and opinions, for and against this genocide. And they're doing the same thing they did in 2020 with the racial justice movement. Yeah. And, you know, they're trying to foment, arguments and they've got an agenda, and their agenda has nothing to do with justice for Palestinians. Mm.
It's a massive question. I wasn't really intending necessarily to go down this line of questioning, but I think it's a very interesting one, because you mentioned before, obviously, the movement against the Vietnam War, and that while it might not have been bigger internationally, it was perhaps better organized. I think this is a really interesting question, what you're saying about social media, because one thing that strikes me is that it seems that, you know, these days people know more than ever in a sense. And so, you know, people have more awareness of what's happening with the genocide in Gaza. And yet the actual ability to do something about it seems a lot less than perhaps it was even, 20, 30 years ago. in terms of we lack the kind of the physical institutions, our trade unions, our church groups, our community organizations that previously were able to organize and, I guess, project power and collectively do something, you know, whether that be striking or direct action or whatever that may be. It seems these days that, you know, the activism has very much gone online. So I guess a bit of a difficult question, but, you know, your thoughts on that, and what role do you think that your music and your playing can play in that? Obviously, you're still playing in public spaces. You're still touring Australia at the moment, that we'll get onto in a moment. But, what, you know, in terms of bringing it back to perhaps, you know, that organization, physical community, you know, what role do you think you can play in that? And do you think that's a significant and important aspect of what's going on in these modern times?
Yeah, I think it's so important. I think, you know, before, I mean, it's not all like a question of before and after social media. It's been a trajectory. It's been going on for a long time. But like when you talk about the institutions, like, you know, this is something that is so just, you know, it's impossible to overemphasize how much of a difference it makes when you're talking about like a situation like the United States, even prior to social media, and trying to do tours and play for left groups and stuff, where in the United States you have just virtually no labor unions that are involved with any kind of, you know, cultural activities or any kind of like broad organizing efforts beyond union, you know, organizing very specifically, but none of the kind of like labor union federations that are engaged in massive popular education campaigns like you have in so many other countries. And you don't have unions having the kind of infrastructure where they have, like, you know, buildings and theaters and all this kind of stuff, like where like they have on in so many other countries outside of the United States, where I play, like in Europe, and even to a really much bigger extent than in the U.S. In Australia, where they, at least, you know, until recently, like every city had trades halls that had all kinds of events going on that you could easily use, and there was funding available, and that's still much, much more the case in Europe than it is in the United States. But what's happened since the sort of social media platforms have taken over our everything, our means of communication, and even we're having events online, and, you know, still doing it even though the pandemic's not happening. It's still a really common phenomena. You know, there's pros and cons to that. It's not that, you know, nothing should happen online, but the sort of atomization of society and the inability of people to effectively organize, specifically in the United States, since the rise of social media, has just been really incredibly depressing. And you know, and now it's to the point where, for various reasons, between the inability of people to organize anymore, the death of the music economy because of Spotify starting their free tier in 2013, you know, and a variety of other reasons, I don't tour in the United States anymore. You know, I regret it very much every day, but I haven't been able to do a tour there for 11 years.
Wow.
I tour in Europe and Australia and, you know, Canada, but I can't tour, like, really. I can do a tour on the West Coast. I can do little bits of regional tours, but I can't do the kind of touring I used to do. I used to spend most of my time on the road in the United States touring. And the power of that, when that was possible, when there was me and so many other musicians and speakers and work people running workshops and teachings and all kinds of, like, the economy for doing this kind of touring was huge in the U.S., before, and that ended partially coincidentally and partially not around the time that social media took off. There were other reasons why that ended, that whole economy, the college circuit, you know, but it collapsed, and a lot of other things fell apart when that did too. And I'd say really that the American left started collapsing as well and lost its ability to effectively organize around the same time.
Well, if we can end on perhaps a, you know, more positive note, you are here in Australia touring, and, you know, and I guess people can be a part of that rebuilding of that left community by coming to a show, by meeting other like-minded people. You're playing here in Perth this Saturday night, I believe. Can you give us the details of that, and you know, where else you'll be around in these coming weeks?
Yeah, if people go to, I should have all the details right here, but if people go to davidrovics.com/tour, there's all the details for the 11 gigs I'll be doing, me and Kamala singing with me, all over Australia, and we'll be in Perth, and otherwise we'll be between Brisbane and Ballarat, and we'll be doing gigs in all kinds of different cities and singing at a lot of different protests as well.
That was American folk singer, author and activist David Rovick speaking to my colleague Ray Grenfell earlier this morning. And as David said right at the end there, he didn't have the details at hand, but we do. He's performing with Kamala Emanuel in concert this Saturday night. There's a dinner at 7 p.m. and a gig at 8 p.m. It's part of the Eco-Socialism Conference happening all weekend at the Borloo Activist Centre. At 5 Aberdeen Street in Perth. So if you look up David Rovick's website or that Eco-Socialism Conference, you can get tickets to that gig. I'm sure it'll be worthwhile. He's a great lad, David, and a good singer. And then speaking of his music, we're going to give you a track, or play a track now for you, rather, from his latest album, Bearing Witness. This is Song for Gaza.
If I could sing a song for every bomb that flies, I'd sing each and all the days. If there were to be a verse for every dying child's cries, for every helpless father's gaze. If I could write a love letter to each corpse as it's carried, I'd never still my pen. If I had to stop a moment for each one as it's buried, I'd never move again. And the stocks are going up somewhere in America. Sing a song for Gaza. For every home that bombs destroy, if I could shed a tear, they would never stop flying. If each broken brick were a heart of a little girl or boy, all the world's children would be crying. If I could hold each shattered body, each baby stilled at birth, I'd have no time for loneliness. I'd spend all my days embracing the people of this savaged earth, feeling the poisoned winds caress. And the war profiteers are laughing somewhere in America. Sing a song for Gaza. If each barren pharmacy were a woman's shining eyes, I'd fall in love forever. If each bombed out hospital were a factory in disguise, wouldn't that be clever? But bricks are only bricks, and dust is only dust, and death is all around. Each minute another missile falls, and sometimes the only thing to trust is the shaking of the ground. And they're loading up the warplanes somewhere in America. Sing a song for Gaza. Sing a song for Gaza.
David Rovick's there, Song for Gaza, from his latest album, Bearing Witness. You're listening to the last few minutes of the Indie Media Show here on RTR FM 92.1, The Sound Alternative, with your host, Alex Wisson. Thanks so much to our guests, David Robics, and to Federico Fuentes as well. Just briefly, we don't really have time to go through it in detail, but an editorial comment worth making in relation to the situation in the Middle East is that tensions are now increasing even further on Israel's northern border with Lebanon. And the latest is that Canada is looking at a full-scale evacuation of its citizens from Lebanon. Kuwaiti Foreign Office has called for its citizens not to travel to Lebanon. The American Middle East envoy, Amos Hochstein, has basically warned that the United States will be supporting an Israeli attack on Lebanon if Hezbollah does not withdraw to behind the Litani River, as per the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701, although there's no chance that Hezbollah will be doing that. So there are more and more signs, unfortunately, that a full-scale war between Israel and Hezbollah is on its way. And who knows where we'll end up if that particular gate to hell is open. But watch this space, basically, on that front. That's all we have time for here at the Indie Media Show. Do stay tuned, of course, for After Lunch with Rhiann Todd-Hunter. We'll be back next week. But until we see you next week, as we say every week, don't hate the media, become the media. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.